Hello, welcome to this conference call for the National Voluntary Consensus Standard for Patient Safety Measures. This is the steering committee's follow-up call to the comment period for the second report. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to the steering committee co-chairs, Dr. Conway and Ms. Lisa Thiemann.
Okay, well, good afternoon. It's Bill Conway. Lisa's going to lead off, and I'm going to clean up today. So, Lisa, I'll pass to you.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Conway. I think we're going to start off initially with a recap, Lisa and Andrew, recap of work to date. And we'll move into review of the second draft report comments and take those in the order that the steering committee would have received the listing. So, Lisa or Andrew?
Yep. Hi, this is Andrew Leisinga, and I actually just really wanted to give a quick update to you all on the surgical site infection measures that we covered in the first report and the harmonization issues that came up during our last call on the public comments for that first report. As you may recall, we had postponed consideration of that set of HAI measures so that we could wait for the measure developers of those SSI measures, which were the CDC and the ACS, to hold some talks and some negotiations on possibly working to harmonize those measures and potentially to come up with a single harmonized measure for surgical site infections. The last we told you, we had just postponed consideration, again, of that report and those measures. And they have proceeded with their negotiations, with their talks, and they have made some progress, but they're still working it out, and they're not quite to the point where we thought they might be or hoped they might be at this point. And so what we're going to do, what we've decided, is that we're going to pull those SSI measures out of the project for the time being. We're going to take the rest of the HAI measures, that would be two UTI measures and a CLABSI measure, and we're going to consolidate those all into a single report with these radiation dosing measures and colonoscope processing measures. So we'll just be putting out a single report now with all of the measures that were recommended for endorsement, not including the SSI measures, which are going to be postponed until a later date, a subsequent project, potentially the upcoming maintenance project or potentially another project. So that is the update on that situation. Anybody have any questions on that or comments?
This is Steve Wallace. Would it also the report include whatever discussion results we have today?
Yes, it would. It would.
Okay.
Any other comments? If not, then I'll turn it back to Lisa, and we can go ahead and proceed with the review of the comments on this second draft report.
Terrific. Thank you, Andrew. As the steering members, committee members would have received, you would have received an Excel spreadsheet listing the comments received by NQF, and thank you to NQF staff for putting it in such a user-friendly format such that we can filter them according to the individual performance measure. And the five measures that were up for consideration by NQF members was public. And so the order that we have them listed here are PFM 43 and 44, then 14, 15, and then we'll move on to 10. So if we take 43 and 44, together and review those. And so if we can filter the Excel spreadsheet by 43 and 44, I think that might be easier for individuals who are on the website looking at that. Just to provide an overview of comments that NQF received on this, several of them focused on the value of using a dose indice versus as a proxy for absorbed radiation dose. The measure developers for each of these did five responses at NQF staff request. And they also questioned whether simple attestation to participation in the dose registry, this is particular to 043, really improves quality. And the measure developers' response is that there is precedent for that through the example of the Society for Thoracic and Surgeons. There is proposed language edits to the draft report, so that would be something that we do need to take an action on, whether we support the language as it's proposed for edits in the draft report. That language is the same for, it applies to 043 and 044 similarly, and it is speaking to adding edits concerning the steering committee had discussed and expressed a concern or acknowledged that there were some variances or the measures did not take into consideration patient age or patient. There was no stratification according to weight. So concerning 043, does any of the steering committee members have particular comments in response to comments received on 43?
No.
No. Okay. And it's also my understanding that one of our steering committee members, Dr. Paul Nagy, you had also submitted some edits that I don't think we see in this Excel spreadsheet.
I just provided some edits on the wording about the radiation dose index. I think we certainly can address that the radiation dose index is probably the most important measure next to sticking ionization chambers into people's organs to measure the exact dose. And it is highly correlated. I think it was responded well by the developer responses.
Great. Okay. And the other note that I believe you had made concerns that the committee had agreed on the importance of using open standards file format.
Yes, absolutely. But that wasn't that was not raised by any of our open comments.
All right. So why don't we take proposed edits that Dr. Nagy has proposed here, steering committee members, accepting of these edits? Yes.
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 Do we have any no's? Not hearing any. Do we have anyone abstaining?
Sal Levine will abstain.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Alan Levine.
Okay. Alisa, do you have that?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. And if we can go back to on the website the edits that were proposed in response to, I believe it was, James Brink. There is some language on the right-hand column there that speaks to the steering committee members' comments about patient age as well as no weight stratification. Are the committee members supportive of these? Any comments concerning these edits? No comments, all right. Not hearing any comments at this point. Are these edits acceptable to the steering committee? Yes?
Yes.
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 Do we hear any no's? Anyone abstaining? Okay. Alisa?
Yeah.
Okay with that?
Yes.
All right. Why don't we move on to PSM 044? Now, there were several comments that overlapped PSM 043 and 044, similar comments concerning dose indices and different aspects like that. However, there were some that were unique to PSM 044. For example, Michael Rapp at CMS indicated who was it attributed to, a physician or a radiology technician. Similarly, AHA questioned the extent of measures of the degree of testing within the field that 044 has undergone. Should there be any exclusions added, such as when there's multi-studies done? And then another unique comment to 44 was AMA's comment concerning manufacturers should collaborate to achieve uniformity through calibration standards. Now, if we filter by 44, you'll see on the screen right now the comment by James Brink, which actually spoke to 4-3 and also has the language that we've just approved for more broadly for 4-3 and 4-4. Now, it's my understanding, I don't believe Dr. Benman is on the call. Is that correct?
She may be on the call. Operator?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you please check if Dr. Rebecca Benman is on the call on the public line?
I do not have a Rebecca Benman.
Okay.
I can open up all the lines. Maybe she's sitting with someone.
She was going to call in individually, so if she does announce herself, if you could let us know.
Yes, I will let you know when she joins.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. Now, it's my understanding Dr. Smith-Minden had received the comments made by NQF members of the public and that she has developed a response that you see in the measure submit a response column. In addition, it's my understanding that she has is potentially considering based on hello?
Yeah, this is Steve Clark. I just joined.
Hi, Dr. Clark.
Hi there.
Dr. Clark, this is Lisa Beeman. We are just moving through the measures. We are on 044 of the agenda.
Okay,
so
thank you.
So we're in the beginning phases.
Okay, thanks.
Great. It's my understanding that Dr. Smith-Finman had proposed making edits to the measure that she submitted such that it would substantially change what the NQF members or the public have had an opportunity to read the comments on. Is that correct, Lisa and Andrew?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Given that you've made that suggestion, how does the steering committee feel about whether or not that would be an appropriate action for this measure at this time, given the comments received thus far on performance measure 44?
I'm sorry, you think she's made changes to the measure that we're not aware of?
It's my understanding she's proposing to add it. This measure currently has two arms, and she's proposing to add what I would constitute as a third arm. And I don't know if we're able to, without her here, speak to this very much. Alisa, would you have the guidance on that?
Well, what we can do is bring it up on the screen. And these suggestions that we got from her arrived to us at the end of last week. And so what Lindsay's going to try to do is pull them up so that everyone could see them. And I don't know, Lisa, can you see the comments on there?
I can. I don't have glasses, but
sorry about that.
That's okay. Essentially, where that I can't. There was one email that I was thinking about where she speaks to that she's considering adding a third option for reporting and capturing that people could report to her if she was the one.
Yeah, so we'll pull that up too. That should have been. That should have been the email that arrived on Wednesday the 16th.
Okay.
And it should be at the bottom of that.
Now, this might be difficult for people to see, so I don't know if you're able to enlarge it on the...
Lisa, I don't know if you have your printed copy out. I think it would be okay to read her suggestions for everyone.
Okay. Let me just get them. Perfect. Reading from the February 16th, email from Dr. Smith-Minden, she had received the comments and there are, and as in her email she writes, there are two metrics in this measure I propose, one estimating average doses and two recording in the patient medical records these values. I would like to add a third, which is reporting these measures, open friends, anonymously, close friends, to groups that would do audits. I mentioned on my call that if I could find no other groups to take on this job, that I would do so. If this were a part of the measure, it would very much encourage facilities to report their data, leading to rapid capacity to create benchmarks, which the lack of U.S.-based benchmarks were one of the concerns that were, and this is not in her email, but just making recollection for the committee members, steering committee members, that was one of the concerns voiced by one of the commenters. Going back to her email, I will work with several groups to see if I can convince them to take on this role, but if I can't, as I mentioned on the steering committee call, I will do this. This is, would obviously need to be discussed by the committee, but wondering if there's any chance we can still have it considered. So as she somewhat raises within her email, and this is not in her email, this is me, she recognizes that it might not be within the steering committee's ability or willingness to allow such a significant edit to the performance measure since it's already gone out to the NQF members and the public for comment. So going back to the discussion at hand, does the steering committee, what are your thoughts on allowing the edits as proposed by Dr. Binman?
This is Steve Wallace. I have a point of clarification. It looks like the third piece that she's adding is more of like an audit function to testing the other or to track the other measures rather than a separate measure. Am I interpreting it wrong?
No, I've not had a conversation with Dr. Binman. Lisa, I don't know if you or Andrew either of you have had that, so you'd be able to offer any insights. But without her on the call, it's hard for me to speculate what she is truly proposing.
Yeah, unfortunately we haven't. We've been playing phone tag. She's been unavailable, actually on vacation, so she was going to call in while she was on vacation. So that's the unfortunate piece of this, trying to get more information to understand some of the suggestions she's put in her email.
Right, and this is the only thing I would suggest to Steve Lawls again is that this is a proposal of a third measure not asked by us in the discussions to clarify or to bring in. Is she bringing it forth? Wouldn't it be better if she did this through the normal channels? Because it's actually a third measure rather than a clarification of the first one or two.
Yes, Dr. Lawless, that's a good point, because this is not an edit that the steering committee has sought from her. This is her reviewing the comments from the public and looking to answer those.
Right.
And so since this is, you know, somewhat of a substantial edit, there is another alternative if the steering committee, you know, would like to consider this. As all of us know, that there is a maintenance phase for patient safety measures that NQF is considering meaning. And during the maintenance phase, it is possible for measure developers to submit new measures. So there is a possibility that if you would like to continue to refine this, either through making a separate third or the bundle through Sphere Together continues, that she would have another opportunity to continue working and then resubmitting during the maintenance phase.
This is Iona from Utah. I actually interpret her edits differently, which is I don't see it as a new measure. What I interpret from that language is that she's asking that the measure include a reporting function for auditing purposes, which is a different, in my view, a different level of authority than approving a specific measure that then goes out into the public domain and is chosen or not chosen depending on what authority is behind it, et cetera. So I would not feel comfortable approving this with that additional language for that reason.
I would tend to agree. This is a little late, and it's beyond the opportunity for members to comment. It ought to come back through some other route.
This is Alan Levine. I'd just go back a step. Tell me if this is inappropriate to step back like this, and I'm going to rely on people that are more technically versed in these issues than I am to provide an answer. I presume it would be appropriate to mention the comments from the National Partnership for Women and Families on the dosage issue. I just want to quote from the matrix that NQF sent out in terms of what the partnership said. We would appreciate NQF explaining in greater detail how being able to compare and benchmark CT dosing levels, which is the argument for why this measure is important, will lead to patient safety improvements related to radiation absorption. We ask that pre-voting report from the committee discuss with more clarity and detail so that consumer and purchaser members can make an informed voting decision. And there's a response to that, and I'm not sure from a technical standpoint, I understand whether it's it adequately addresses the comment in terms of dosage and absorption.
I'm sorry, is your...
Jessica, are you running the laptop that we're seeing on the webinar? If possible, we'd be able to pull up the comments that were submitted by the National Partnership for Women and Families.
Making a distinction between dosage and absorption. And the response to that, I'm just not technically George, to know whether it's an adequate response. I guess she says it's very difficult to do, and then she gives some kind of caveats.
This is Paul Nagy, and I can try to answer or synthesize some of that response for you. And so the dose index is measured off of phantoms, and if you get like 1,000 milligrays per centimeter, if you then give 2,000 milligrays per centimeter, then you're basically doubling the absorbed dose. Well, we don't have – it's highly correlated to dose. We know that there's some inaccuracies because of the patient's size and the heterogeneity of the organs to actually determine what the specific organ dose is. And so we can't directly tell you exactly what the dose, absorbed dose is, but we can tell you what that dose would be to in a phantom. That's what we call the dose index. And it is widely accepted as the most important measure for radiation dose absorption as defined by the American Association of Physicists in Medicine. And so it's highly correlated, but it's not trying to assume that we know exactly what the dose is because really we're just calibrating this to a phantom. But the truth is that's as good as we're going to be able to get without doing invasive techniques like having ionization chambers used as part of the procedure.
Well, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Well, I do think when you see a high, and I think a lot, both of these measures, and I think there's some great comments in here about, well, can't we just define levels that you should not exceed, and we just benchmark off of that? And I think both these measures are getting at the fact that we've got a wide range of variation. There's like several, there's about 100 different CT procedures you're going to be doing on different parts of the body, and the dose range can be highly variable. And I think what they're trying to get at is trying to be able to get to where we can define national standards for what those optimal dosage measures should be. The challenges are when you have a heavier patient, you're going to need to use more photons or more radiation to be able to maintain diagnostic image quality. And so you want to leave some variability based upon the procedure and the anatomy that you're looking at and not be too prescriptive over the physician. And so I think this is what both these measures are trying to get at is what we call or what I'm considering reducing the variation in protocol. And that one site with their CTs of the heads are doing 2 to 3 times the dose index of another site, and it really kind of begs the question of what best practices aren't they sharing. And so I think these both of these measures are trying to get into a stage where we can have that data. The comment I had about Rebecca Smith-Beinman's third measure was, and I guess I see it interpreted differently, which is part of the problem. I think we're all in creating different interpretations of what she's trying to get at. It sounds to me a little bit like we have to then look at harmonization with the registry as well, and then it looks like there's a bit of overlap that we might want to try to harmonize when it gets into a reporting mechanism like that.
This is Lisa. Do any other steering committee members? Thank you for those comments and that clarification, Dr. Nagy. Are any other comments from the steering committee concerning TSM-44? I think without having Dr. Binman here, it's difficult. I think we all are reading this in a very different way based on our personal, based on our experiences and understanding of the topic. So I would have concerns that if we move forward to place this into a voting mechanism with these edits without they feel it without having the opportunity for the NQF members, stakeholders, and the public to comment on this edit, I would have concerns about that. And similarly, since we don't have a full understanding of what Dr. Binman is suggesting through these edits, I'm concerned about moving those forward in that manner. Any comments?
I support that.
Support.
Support.
Agree.
Support.
Okay. Anyone feel contrary to that opinion and feel that we should move them forward into the voting draft as written, as previously written, without edits?
I guess.
So you're saying, should we evaluate this as is it currently written without the additions that Rebecca suggested, right?
Well, that's one of the, one of the difficulties of not having her here. She may feel herself, based on the comments, that there's still some work, and I can't speak for her. If she, as the measure developer, feels that there is some tweaking or some further refinement that could easily happen to the measure in order to make it a more robust, reliable measure, then personally I would be inclined to let her do that and then resubmit during the maintenance phase. And then it also allows for if she is proposing somewhat of an overlap similar to the data registry component through the auditing mechanism, then that would allow for harmonization as well. Any thoughts?
This sounds like so much speculation.
I hate to say it, that's how I feel. I know that's my personal opinion. I don't want to speak to the group, but...
This is Steve Lawless. I would feel comfortable that because she's the developer or she's the submitter developer of the measure, that she's asking, or it sounds like she's asking, that she needs to do some clarifications on that rather than she's acting as a public comment to the measures we've discussed.
Correct. It's my understanding that, and Alisa and Andrew, please clarify if I'm incorrect in this, that her proposed edits were in direct response to concerns that the commenters made about this measure.
Yes, that does appear to be the case.
But she's not changing the two measures that she submitted and we've reviewed.
Well, it's really just a single measure. And it has two components, or at least this is the way I would interpret it. And again, we're all kind of interpreting it a little differently, it seems here. And it seems that she wants to add a third component in addition to those first two, which were, taking the dose index and recording it in the medical record. Those were the first two components. It seems that she wants to add a third component to the measure, which is a more explicit public reporting element, a requirement that dose index that's reported in the medical record be reported out to some public entity or to her herself, as she mentioned in her email.
Mm-hmm.
And that does seem, as we've discussed, to be something of a substantial edit to the measure.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for that clarification, Andrew. So at this point, does the committee feel comfortable taking a straw poll on whether the measure should move forward into the voting draft as originally constructed with the two components to the one measure without the third edit, the third component? Do you feel comfortable taking a straw poll on that point right there?
Sure.
I think the original measure, as we had discussed it, is sufficient to go forward, and let's just exclude this edit at this point.
So move.
Okay.
Agree.
Agree.
Yes.
Yes.
Do we have any no's to not moving? Do we have anyone who does not support moving it forward to the voting draft? Anyone abstaining? Okay. Elise and Andrew?
Hello.
You have that?
Yes, we did. Thank you.
All right. Okay. So then the steering committee, Elise, I guess we would follow, staff would follow up with Dr. Binman to indicate that there was no edits necessary to this, to the measure from the steering committee's perspective, and that the measure as originally specified would move forward to the voting draft, to the membership.
Yes, and all of her other comments, I guess the committee is in agreement with those as well. So we'll communicate that to her.
Okay, great. Right. So done with the radiology measures. Moving on to the colonoscopy measures, or colonoscope, I should say, not necessarily colonoscopy, which are PSM 014, 15, and 16 on the agenda. In general, the comments that NQF received about this, about these three measures, had mostly to do with whether the measures should be considered standard of care, standard of practice, rather than, or internal quality improvement, rather than performance measures for quality, such as this, for NQF endorsement. There were comments by the National Partnership for Women and Families, and in addition, some other commenters made that similar notation. So from a committee's perspective, and I believe that AAAHC Quality Institute, who I believe Naomi Kuznets is on the phone line, developed a response to those commenters, which outlined the background rationale for why AAAHC Institute for Quality Improvement did submit these forward to NQF for consideration, because there was a failure to adhere to these at the local level. So from a committee perspective, there is some discussion that that might be beneficial, and I don't know if we can pull up our old minutes from our previous discussion on this point, because it's my recollection that the committee did discuss that these were quote-unquote accreditation more so, but that the failure to have these, you know, be adhered to in the clinical practice made them important enough in order to drive quality. So it might be helpful for the steering committee to either reiterate some of why we felt that these three measures were important for NQF to recommend endorsement and put out in the quality arena. Any comments?
Yeah, this is Alan Levine, one of the consumer representatives. I guess I'm still torn on this. It's one of the original steering committee meetings where this was discussed. I raised the issue of accreditation and oversight. And I remember sort of after that came up being convinced that maybe it has to be drilled down to performance measures. But after looking at the comments in terms of that this is really the accreditation and oversight problem, I'm going back and forth in my own mind, quite honestly. I guess in a way, when self-regulation isn't working, then you've got to step in with something, and that's what I'm trying to balance in my own mind. And the National Partnership made a good point, but where does this end in terms of medical devices? Is there a performance measure for the maintenance, cleaning, and education of people that deal with medical devices? So I guess I'm struggling with that in my own mind, but I guess I'd just like to hear from other people on this also.
Yeah, this is Steve Wallace. I'm a little more with you, actually, Alan, and this is that I can remember when they presented their argument, it was they needed something relatively urgently to be done to get the momentum rolling. This is definitely crediting OSHA, accreditation OSHA. And the question is, if we don't do it, who else would? But I do have the same considerations, and I'm torn by this.
Any other comments from steering committee members?
There were a couple of other observations made in the spreadsheet. One was about the idea of the clinical practice, who owns it, and I think it was from AMA saying that this was something that the physicians didn't have direct control over, that involved other health professionals in their practice, and then making it a publicly reportable item in terms of responsibility and accountability in the future, some concerns raised about that. And then also the directing, the link between process and outcome. I think we're all in agreement that appropriate sterile technique is, you know, necessary regardless of what the facility is or who's responsible, et cetera. But I also am waffling on whether or not this is truly a patient safety measure that ought to be endorsed by NQF. I think somebody, when I can't remember who else raised the concern about the evidence that would support. It's an infection control practice concern, and unfortunately, there is there's evidence to support sterile technique and control of infections, but the tying in the specific practice to the outcome is a little bit more gray.
Okay. Any other comments?
I mean, I'm this is Dan Solomon. I'm just looking for some guidance from NQF. It seems this is kind of a meta issue. Are we going to create performance measures around basic practice, or is this? So I'm getting back to the point that was raised earlier that I don't know if we know how to respond to that issue. And I don't know if NQF has some thoughts about that.
Hi, this is Heidi. I thought I'd just chime in here. I mean, what we really are looking for you all to do, and you did it before, and then now you've got the input from the membership and the public, is look at whether these measures truly meet the criteria. And I think the one that I personally am struggling with now is this something that is useful for public reporting? Does it meet the importance component? So does it have a true gap in care? Does it have evidence for the high impact? And then the evidence just in general. And so I think what would be helpful is if you all can provide guidance on whether you think indeed it does, these measures do meet that. And if you do, then I think we move it forward. But I will tell you, these types of measures that tend to be more structural are very hard to, I think, put forward and say that they really, you have to have a really solid evidence base, solid, make a solid case for importance on these types of measures. And I think the question is to the committee, has that been made here?
This is Diana again. I think it's globally important, but I think the struggle I'm having is that the specificity of it and tying it back in, I think one of the examples in the spreadsheet used the example of prophylactic administration of antibiotics and that direct relationship to infection rates, that there is a direct relationship between process and outcome, or, you know, aspirin within a certain window of time, et cetera. This is too, it's global. It's not specific enough to really, I think, say that the evidence is strong enough to support it. It's important in its global nature of infection control, but in the specific accountability and being able to report on it, et cetera, that's where I think it falls down, and that's just my opinion.
I thought we were provided a number of studies where a breakdown in management of scopes led to outbreaks of disease.
We were. Remember, the VA was the issue the VA brought forth about their, there was a breakdown in the certifications of the people doing the colonoscopy cleansing or whatever, and that caused a cluster infection.
So that link is there.
Okay.
Yeah, there is. There's actually, there have been several reports with several thousand patient notifications needed due to improper reprocessing of colonoscope and exposure to bloodborne pathogens potentially for patients.
So, okay, so if that's the case, then is this a regulatory question or a patient safety question or both?
By regulatory, are you meaning accreditation?
Yes. So if there's a breakdown in the process that results in that kind of outcome, is that should we be reporting on it for purposes of public accountability, or should there be a regulatory response to that breakdown? Or do
those
things come together? I don't know.
And, you know, I think that unfortunately that is the difficulty is that we've previously had these outbreaks have occurred in places that were accredited. What was that?
That were accredited.
Yeah, well, and right, that were. And that, you know, you also have an aspect of many locations that perform colonoscopies that are not accredited. And so that was the premise for expanding that as well when the committee made the recommendation to the measure developer to expand the clinical settings and where this would apply to. Because what we've seen in accreditation and how effective accreditation may have been in the past or not been in the past on these issues, I think that's the premise behind why the measure developer, I can't speak for the measure developer, and so maybe it might be helpful if we ask if the committee is willing to have Naomi Cousin comment on this.
And we do have her line if you'd like me to open it now.
Yes.
So can I hate to do this, but to drill down in terms of the accreditation process, I mean, what is it about the accreditation process that failed in these instances? Was it they didn't have the resources, they didn't look at the right places, the guidelines they followed weren't right. Does anyone have a, I mean, what, I guess maybe, I don't
General,
know, I know, there's, I know, I'm aware of the problems with the VA, but was
right.
That, they didn't do the reviews, or somehow the reviews that were done were kind of myopic?
Well, it's my understanding, and, well, according to, I think Naomi may be able to speak more to AAAHC specifically, but, generally, accreditation processes have their standards may range to the facility has a policy for XYZ, and when you're going through an accreditation survey review, the surveyors will validate that XYZ was followed. Okay? To my knowledge, most accreditation programs do not have this level of granularity which speak directly to a procedure like colonoscopy. And so this is unique in that situation.
I mean,
okay.
It's the difference between a sampling technique, which is what regulators and accreditors use, and then an expectation that if this was a national safe practice, that it would be done every patient every time.
Right.
Can you open the line?
Yep. Operator, would you open the line for Jessica?
Her line is open.
Okay. Yeah, I would like to substantiate what you're saying. Usually accreditors come in every 3 years. They're on site for a very limited period of time. They have a lot of paper documentation and they have a lot of observation to do in a very short period of time. The ability to keep up with changing practices in those 3 years is very limited. And we do know that scopes change very rapidly, the instructions change very rapidly, and the ability to drill down to that level and be sure that it's going to be up to date for the next 3 years is minimized by the whole process.
Do the state licensing authorities defer to the accreditation, or do they do their own reviews?
Okay, it depends on the state. Some of them deem organizations like AAAHC or Joint Commission or others. Others of them have actually totally gone to these organizations like California. California has not been able to keep up with its obligations to go into organizations at regular periods of time. So pretty much in order to be licensed, you would have to go through an accreditation organization. And the surveys are very, very similar from one to another to the states. They have to be in order for the states to allow these organizations to be deemed. This is Iona. The speaker prior to this last speaker made a comment and framed this in a little bit different way than I was thinking about it, which is you used the concept safe practice. So, or maybe it was you, the last speaker, I can't remember. Anyway, the idea that this would be an appropriate measure related to a safe practice, to me, is a little bit different than what I've been thinking prior. And I like the idea of being able to measure safe practices. We've been measuring, many of the measures are after the fact, trying to measure infections when they occur and sentinel events when they occur, seriously reportable events, et cetera. And maybe my struggle is this does shift from that sort of mentality to this idea of a safe practice mentality, which is getting up the chain of the supply curve, so to speak. And in that context, it makes a little more sense to me.
And that was our intention. We don't want to see this happen over and over again.
Right. I would...
Iona, then I'm going to ask a question just from a clarification perspective, because as many people are aware, NQF has safe practices as well. And what I'm hearing you say is that this is better placed under safe practices, which currently is out for vote now, I believe, on the safe practices, correct, Lisa and Andrew?
No, actually, we finished up an update to the safe practices in 2010. We don't have one another update imminent, but...
Lisa, I think you're thinking of the serious reportable event.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's what I'm saying.
But one of the struggles, though, is that that I'm having. So recently, we've just put together a survey, which ends up being a self-reporting survey on safe practices. How well have you institutionalized these various safe practices? And the problem with it right now with the safe practices is that they're not objectively measured. We're going on self-report survey kind of methodology to trying to determine whether or not these safe practices have been incorporated at the institutional and delivery level. So this idea of having some measures, objective measures, although this is still would be a self-report, but a little more down the road in terms of some sort of objective measure of a safe practice is very appealing outside, you know, rather than just a survey response, if that makes sense to people.
So am I hearing, Iona, just to clarify, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding you correctly. So I'm hearing that that you do support these three measures as currently specified within the patient safety measures project, though.
It's a little bit different thinking, and if safe practices falls under this steering committee's responsibility, yes. If safe practices is a different sort of animal that we haven't really addressed yet or we don't have a place to put and we need to maybe deal with that issue, then I would say no, not so much.
This is Alan Levine. I guess, you know, thinking about this conference call in advance, I actually struggle with this type of paradigm in terms of quality improvement, patient safety, performance measures, and safe practices. And I kept coming back to the one idea that I know pretty well is Peter Pronovost's ICU, you know, checklist. And that would be a safe practice. I mean, it's done remarkable things, in ICUs. Reducing central line infections. And that's basically a reminder of what is expected of people. And this is sort of similar to that. And again, I was struggling with trying with this paradigm of performance measures versus safe practices. And with Iona's bringing this to the fore like this, I think in my own mind, this seems more suited to a safe practice, something that you would normally expect of people. Whether it's like in a surgical situation, a timeout, but I don't know. That seems to resolve the conflict in my mind in terms of the oversight issue and performance measure issue. Maybe it's not in the wrong. Maybe it's in the wrong NQF queue, if you will, or silo.
absolutely. Well, I think the part of the challenge is how are we looking at patient safety, okay? And if we're looking at items that enhance patient safety, and if that's the definition, the operational definition that's used for the group, and then would this qualify as that? What I'm hearing from at least two of the steering committee members is that this is not a patient safety measure.
Well, I think if I reflect back on what Heidi brought out into this discussion, I'm concluding slightly differently. I think that this is a patient safety measure, that we have in fact established that there are gaps in care, and given the relatively high prevalence of colonoscopies in their country, we do have an issue potentially of patient safety, and that we have established the link in terms of the processing and the outcome. So I'm struggling with the struggle to not make this patient safety outcome measure.
This is Jan Allison, and, you know, I've worked in the surgery centers, and I was at a disadvantage. I couldn't be there on the day that the steering committee met and that we did have our discussions, but I felt very strongly was that Dr. Connolly that just spoke?
No, it was Dr. Turner.
Okay, well, I felt very strongly in just what you said. And then, obviously, after reading these comments, then it sort of – I just really had to mull it over. And at first I felt a little conflicted, and then I'm just thinking after all this discussion, I really concur with what he just said. I really do see this as a patient safety measure. In my mind, in knowing how the ambulatory surgery center industry is, and where a lot of them are falling down in their currency of their practices, of their education, of their competencies, and how, you know, obviously it can be prevented. And I don't see that there's a challenge either in them having the data readily available to themselves in order to be able to report it. I noticed that was a comment in what I had read, and it's really not. There's no way it has to be. It's very easily retrievable. So that's my thinking.
Any other committee members comment?
Yeah, I had a question.
Is this Mr. Lane?
Yes, sorry. When we talk about reporting and performance measures, public reporting, is there another side to the coin in terms of validation? And if there is, would the accreditation organizations be the ones that would validate the data? Would that be left up to state licensing people or whomever? I mean, there are some states, more and more states are now requiring validation surveys of what's being publicly reported.
This is Naomi Kuzet. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, our in the process of testing this measure, we would be checking the reliability and the validity of our measurement activities through some of the accreditation processes with some very specific worksheets. We would hope to do that. I think one of the things that we need to think about, and this would be a good consumer education concept, is it more important to know that that there's been a failure at a place, or is it more important to know that the organization has reliably got processes in place that are there to ensure patient safety? I would rather go to an ambulatory surgery center that has processes in place than one that might have just had an incident. That place with an incident probably has a much better compliance rate now than it used to. So I think that's one of the ways we need to look at this in terms of public understanding of what this would do.
This is Steve Lawless.
This is Alan. We talked about having a certain time frame on it, or is that a different set of measures?
These are time. We'll have to go through
testing.
Say that again, please.
Yeah. These are time limited. These are recommended for endorsements and time limited.
And what would that time frame be?
I'm sorry, what?
What would the time period be?
Elisa, is it 2 years or 3 years?
This is Heidi. So to provide the testing results back, it would be 12 months.
12 months.
And then full maintenance will be at the end of 3 years.
Thank you. That's what I was thinking of.
This is Steve Lawless. I'm hearing the comments is that I'm actually getting more encouraged that this is actually a leading safety practice indicator, which is really nice. And the person who just mentioned it, it's that we're taking a little bit more of like the equivalent of getting aspirin to prevent heart attacks. But this is a structural leading indicator. So I'm actually getting more encouraged to actually continue on with it.
Yeah, it's sort of the beta blocker after AMI.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I know I'm going to, not intending to call anybody out, but because I want to make sure that everybody, all the steering committee members have had an opportunity to comment. Anyone else who, concerning where they're considered the straw poll in some ways, where they're coming down on these three measures, in favor of continuing forward with them or struggling with continuing forward?
I would continue forward. I'm trying to reflect on where we are. The issue here is responding to members' comments. Most of them were positive. There were a couple of concerned that this is a slippery slope and we'll be recommending safety measures like this for every procedure and device. I don't think that's the case. This is a unique high-risk procedure that is demonstrated in this country lots of failures.
Mm-hmm.
So
which is also required.
I see this in nasal endoscopy or bronchoscopy or other procedures. So it's unique. I don't think we're on a slippery slope of having a dozen of these approved.
In fact, Dr. Conway,
the other element as well is that that the concerns about slippery slopes, every performance measure is evaluated on its own integrity.
Right.
And so the performance measure developer has it's on their responsibility to demonstrate a true link and gap. And so the concern that everything will rise to this level, I don't know that there would be a gap on everything that a future steering committee would say, yes, let's go ahead with everything.
Yeah, but this is Steve Lawless. The difference of this procedure versus others is that this is one that most insurance carriers and everybody encourages everybody to take. So it's almost like a required procedure over age 50.
Another difference.
True. Sure, there's a high utilization.
Any cancer screening tests? Mm-hmm. How about a pap smear? Are there going to be similar safety issues?
Why not?
That could get raised about pap smear, for example.
It would be the measure developer's responsibility to demonstrate that there was patient harm through that. And that's where I think this measure is unique in that there has been demonstrated harm for bloodborne pathogen transmission. Now, of course, if thousands of women were contacted that they were exposed to bloodborne pathogen, then through undergoing pap smears or pelvic examinations, then that may raise the issue as well.
I think a lot of the speculums are actually disposable now.
True.
If we're going to get that specific.
Yeah. Are there any other comments? I don't want to...
Yeah. What percent of these surgical centers aren't accredited and what does it mean if they're not accredited? Are they not even seen by the state licensing people? They can't exist outside of a regulatory vacuum.
Yes, they can. They may be under the physician's license and not necessarily accredited as a separate entity under the facility licensing approach.
And what?
Correct.
What kind of numbers are we talking about? I mean, who? So the physician, there would be no regulatory oversight of the physician's practice?
Well, the physician has regulatory oversight through the Department of Professional Licensing.
Yeah, but they don't. The last thing they do is they don't go to doctors' offices.
Only if there's complaints, correct?
Right. So, what percent of the universe are we talking about in terms of outpatient colonoscopies, and doctors versus licensed facilities, ambulatory care facilities, or ambulatory surgical centers?
How widespread is it?
A large proportion from the National Center for Health Statistics, a large proportion of these are performed in ambulatory surgery centers. And ambulatory surgery centers can have Medicare deemed status without having accreditation.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if we approve this, how would it apply to doctor's offices? I think it does apply to doctor's offices, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I thought it was just ambulatory care centers.
Okay, I thought with this one measure we were talking about extending it to doctor's offices, maybe something else. That was another discussion. So,
office-based surgery, if you do a certain level of anesthesia, is usually regulated by the state and usually has some requirement of either state inspection or accreditation. I think it was the office-based surgery to which you're referring.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
Because extending that outside of the ambulatory to the office-based surgery perspective, many of the people who undergo these procedures have many do and many don't, but, I mean, many have anesthesia services in association with colonoscopy, and so oftentimes they are regulated and accredited. So it would reach down to that level as well.
Hi, this is Chris Cowdley. I'm sorry I had to step in and out here, but I thought I would chime in being a gastroenterologist. So these procedures can sometimes be done in the office and in an ambulatory endoscopy center. So when they're done in the office, there's a different reimbursement structure. When they're done in the ambulatory endoscopy center, there's a different reimbursement structure. I think somebody talked about Medicare. So Medicare reimburses a facility fee and a professional fee for doing the colonoscopy in a ambulatory center that is credentialed. But in the office, there are some people who do colonoscopy in the office, but then you only get that. You get the only one fee. You don't get the facility fee. And there are requirements about what needs to be available in the office for allowing the practitioner to perform that procedure in the office. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Kobe. So turning back to the, at this point, it sounds as if the steering committee should probably take a, looking at the comments, and are we comfortable moving these forward to the voting draft? Do we have any messages?
This is Iona. I think yes, based on this conversation, it's helped clarify my thinking.
Yeah, okay. This is Alan Levine, sure.
I agree.
Yes.
Yes, I also
yes.
agree.
Yes.
Any no's? Any people, anyone abstaining? All right, Elisa and Andrew, you have that?
Yes, we do. And before we proceed, we did forget the public and member comment period after the radiology measure. So, operator, we'd like to open up the lines, the public line, to allow our members and the public to comment on the colonoscope and radiation measures.
Hi, this is Cynthia McCullough. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. Thank you for letting me comment. I'm commenting on the behalf of the American Association of Physicists in Medicine, and I'm commenting specifically on the two radiation measures that were brought forward. We unequivocally support the ACR dose registry. We do have concerns with regard to the measure being proposed by San Francisco. And we sent probably too much technical detail on our concerns. But if I look at line 321 about in the draft standard, the committee had a concern about whether the measures would be usable to patients and non-radiology providers. Our concern is that these dose indices are not, in fact, a measure of dose to the actual patient. They're much better a measure of how the scanner was set up. They do that actually very well, so it's sort of the dial on how the scanner was being used. But it's not the dose to a patient. A few more complicated steps need to happen between those two measures. And in order to ensure patient safety, we, throughout the imaging community, have been stressing over and over through the Image Gently programs and other programs that you need to adjust the scanner output based on patient size and based on the type of exam. If, for example, just from a thin adult to a really heavy adult, you need to change the scanner setting by factor 2 to 3 to accomplish the same task, but that doesn't mean the patient dose changed by a factor of 2 to 3 because they, in self, you know, the heavier patients have more absorbing material. So I don't want to get into all the technical stuff, though I'm happy to answer questions, but our concern is that these numbers being reported directly to patients or physicians, people will consider them all on a level playing field. And so a physician in their office that sent Mrs. Jones last week, and in the report back from the CT, it said her dose index number was 20, and the next day he sees Mr. Jones and his dose number was 60, is going to think, what's going on? Factor 3 variability. And in fact, that factor of 3, if they are the different sizes, is exactly the right and safe thing to do. So we have a strong concern about these numbers being put into the medical record before they have that patient size adjustment done. And at the current time, the tool isn't out there to do that automatically, which is why the dose registry is working to implement that before we put out public measures. I'd be happy to answer questions. Does that overview give you some general sense of our concern?
Thank you, Cynthia, for that overview. Does the steering committee have any questions for Mr. Pollack?
Thank you, Cynthia. This is Paul Nanji. I guess I'm looking at the, is this in the PSM comments document that we received from the AAPM?
The AAPM document, the number that I read off, that line number?
Oh, no, I'm looking at the public comments that we received.
From the AAPM, February 11th, 2011?
Yeah, Lisa, do you know if that's incorporated into this document?
That's what I was just going to ask as well for staff, because in the Excel spreadsheet that we have, I'm looking for your comment.
This concern is different than the ones that have been raised before. This concern, I believe, sounds like it's much more on the public reporting component.
And it's the scientific validity of using those dose numbers for a different measure. The analogy I sometimes use is, you know, your speedometer needs the calibration of your tire size. So even though your engine speed's running at one engine speed, if somebody souped up and put different diameter tires, the speedometer's wrong. And so we would report this dose index number, which is kind of the how fast the engine's running. I come up with strange analogies, sorry. But people interpret it in an absolute sense. That was the dose to this patient or that patient. But patients come in all these different diameters, and so you need that other step in order to be able to interpret it. It's kind of like for medicines, people can say the dose is the milligram per kilogram. We're not taking into account the kilogram.
Now, in the CTD, now I think let me see if I can rephrase this. You're saying for larger patients, the dose index is going to be 3 times as much, but really, in reality, because of skin sparing, there's going to be less dose to the sensitive organs, and so the CTDI is not. There's some question about the complete validity of the CTDI vol metric.
And it's a I think you've got the idea exactly. The metric is a very good metric of what the scanner's putting out. But, for example, if you double the CTDI vol, but you move from an average to a little bit heavier patient, so you've doubled the scanner output, the dose to the internal organs only goes up 20 to 30%. And so that's where this factor of two in, that is how the scanner was running, will be really incorrectly interpreted as this huge variation. All these patients are getting all these different numbers and the community's not got their act together, when really the variation reflects to a large extent just a doing what you're supposed to do and accounting for the patient size. So they're very good metrics, and in Europe they use them for what they call diagnostic reference levels. Same principle, you take a big survey of what everyone's doing, but the difference is they standardize patient size, and they say for the adult between this BMI and that BMI, give us your CTDI vols, give us your dose length products, and from that, they come up with this distribution to see if a practice is running too high compared to their peers.
If I could try to clarify and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the concern here is with the second component of Rebecca's measure, which is the reporting out of the dose index in the patient's medical record. The concern is that that dose will be sent to the doctor and viewed by the patient without context, I guess. So they'll see this you know, maybe a wide variation in a dose that they've given on one day from the next, and not be aware of this difference, that may be a perfectly appropriate difference because of the difference in size of a patient or something like that.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Hello, this is Judy Burleson at the American College of Radiology. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't see Dr. McCullough's or the AAPM's comment in the spreadsheet that's on the website. However, the concern that she raised, or AAPM raised, was also in the ACR comments on PSM-044. The second component of that measure, our concerns were the same as Dr. McCullough's, and I'm not sure that was reviewed by the steering committee. I didn't hear it discussed earlier. There was some discussion about the patient size as context in the measure, but the concern about reporting the dose index in the medical report as a standard measure, I didn't hear discussed.
Sure, this is Paul Nagy. I can respond a little bit to that. I guess it gets into some of our definitions of what the electronic medical record is today. So technically, the electronic medical record number is where we have all of our lab values and all of our reports. The PAC system, which is the image repository for medical images, is actually a legal medical record repository as well. So technically today we already have, typically the CTDI dose report is saved as an image inside the, with all the other medical images folder as part of the, and typically that's in the medical record. It's already in there today. I guess the challenge you have is in the context of sending it out to the referring physicians.
The medical record is one thing, but the measure for the 044 Part B is to put that information into this final approved radiology report, which is part of the medical record, but not in the sense as the information that's stored in the PACS. That is a report that goes out to the treating physician and potentially the patient.
So the challenge is in the reporting mechanism.
Yes.
The metric.
Right.
This is Cynthia again, and that we understand and want the CTDI dose report to be part of the legal record, and we want to mine that data for quality improvement. Absolutely. but it probably is the wording on lines 310, 315, 325 that keep talking about the final medical report that implied much more to me the letter to the physician. And those similar sentences continue to talk about reporting to the patients. And so you know, have husband and wife comparing their dose index numbers for their CT scan, and they're quite off. Without context, they won't have an understanding of what that meant. So we're not likely to help patient safety, but certainly cause a lot of confusion by the reporting aspect.
Did you have a suggestion as to how we could change the language in the report, or is this sort of more of a concern with the measure itself as specified?
Help me understand the interpretation of what the Part A says it's an outcome measure and Part B is a process measure, where Part B says how many exams the dose is included in the final report. So since we are of the opinion it shouldn't be in the final report, we wouldn't want that process implemented. The outcome measure, I think the wording does need a bit of tweak in its own, because on line 312 it says the measure requires the providers to record those. And one of the things it includes is effective dose, which is one of the big sort of scientific problems. If we could remove that, then we would very much like to see sites do these sort of mini dose surveys. But the effective dose wording would probably need to be eliminated, and we would probably want to constrain it for patients of a standard size. And then it would accomplish a really good purpose.
Again, this is a point where it would be really be helpful to have Rebecca here to respond to these concerns, I think. We're proposing some significant revisions of her measure specifications, I think, here. And I guess the steering committee needs to talk about that and whether, in the absence of any, you know, of her being willing to change the specifications, we're still willing to put this measure forward as it is.
This is Iona. I'm sorry. I need to be reminded on the process. So if this moves forward to voting and it is denied from this last conversation versus tabling it and asking the developer to respond again to these comments, what are our options?
Lisa and Heidi, please correct me if I'm wrong in this. This is Lisa. The steering committee could do one of a couple things. You could, as we've previously already done here, the committee had already at this point, prior to hearing the comments of ACR and AAPM, made the recommendation that the measure go forward as previously specified without any proposed edits by the measure developer to the voting. If the measure were to receive consensus by the NQF members, then the member would be endorsed or made recommended to the CFAC for endorsement. The steering committee would make that recommendation after receiving the NQF vote. If the committee at this point, given the new discussion, then if the committee wants to reconsider moving this forward and instead, because we don't have Dr. Bindman on the line, consider delaying it and having her continue to work to edit it in response to AAPM and ACR's comments or other commenters, and then she could reconsider to resubmit during the maintenance phase. Are there any other alternatives, Alisa or Heidi?
No, I think you've captured it well, and I think the question to the committee is, do you feel that the measure, to me it comes down to either you're comfortable with the measure as it's currently specified and written versus whether you think this needs to work. And I was asking Alisa when this needs to go out for vote, and that's March 4th. So we're really looking at a week left to get something turned around and viewed by the committee and then back out for vote. So it's very tight.
Thoughts by the committee members, preferences, and what you'd like to do?
I think this is Paul Nagy. I think those are some very insightful inputs. I think the challenge is trying to perceive what the educational burden is going to be on the referring physician and the patient. I don't know if we can ask Dr. Brendan for any data on that matter. I mean, the question is right. We're going to be reporting technical factors to the patient and to the referring physician, and there's going to be the potential for confusion. And the challenge is going to be how is that going to impact this measure?
Any other thoughts?
This is Iona. From a consumer perspective, one of the things I don't want to see happen is that we endorse a measure that is going to be breed confusion from a consumer perspective. And I would offer to say that probably physicians may or may not have this level of detailed knowledge on the measure as well in terms of their interpretation, some, particularly in the general practice arena. So I'm uncomfortable given the concerns that have been expressed in terms of the metric itself, moving it forward until those issues are clarified and dealt with.
Alan Levine, I would second that, or I agree.
So given that comment, I'd like to ask the committee, does the committee wish to revisit our previous action on this item? Yes?
Yes, I think that was a pretty compelling commentary that we heard, so I would be in favor of revisiting this as well.
Any other yeses?
Yes.
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 Any no's?
Yes.
Any no's? Nope. Okay, anybody abstaining? All right, so going back to PSM 044, does the committee, would the committee like to remove this measure from the voting draft and instead ask the measure developer to continue working to edit the measure and then consider resubmission during the maintenance phase if that's so appropriate? This is giving the short timeline.
I'm sorry, Lisa, would you repeat that again?
Sure. Does the committee, and given that we are going to preface it by, given that we know that we only have 1 week to make voting draft posting, and it's unlikely that the measure developer is able to make the edits and then have us reconvene and re-vote on it. Does the committee wish to pull PSM 044 from the voting draft at this time and instead ask the measure developer to continue working, make edits as the performance measure has already suggested, and then resubmit during the maintenance phase?
This is Iona. I support that.
Yes.
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 Yep.
Yes.
Any no's? Any no's? Anyone abstaining? All right, Elisa and Andrew, I think you have that. Thank you to Judy Burleson and Cynthia McCullough from AAPM.
Hey, Lisa?
Yes.
Could the staff clarify, is this something that we'll have to electronically vote on after the meeting in addition to the straw vote?
This is Heidi. I mean, you do have a quorum on the phone, so as long as we continue to have a quorum, I think it's fine. Unless all of you would like to do an email vote, just to be sure.
Oh, that's fine.
Another survey is probably not on your list if you want to. So.
Okay, great. Recognizing it's 3:30, do we have any other public comments from PSM 04344 or 1516? Not hearing any. I think we're good to move on to PSM 010.
Okay, thank you, Lisa.
Thanks.
We're considering PSM 10, querying and counseling about anti-epileptic drug side effects. We have been asked to reconsider this by the measure developer of the American Academy of Neurology. I'd like to spend a minute to just talk about the process here and allow the committee members to vet any concerns with that. We'll you should all have a letter from the Academy that explains their rationale. I could, if we want, briefly try to summarize that. Lisa sent around the minutes and prior voting record on this measure for your review. Our sole issue today is a yes-no vote on reconsideration. If the vote is to not reconsider this, then things will stay as they are. If the committee supports reconsidering this, then the staff would incorporate it into the voting package for the membership using a write-up of our prior deliberations on this as part of that package. Today on the phone, I'd like to, at the end, take a straw vote of that question. And I was told by Elisa that we might have to vote on it electronically, but if we can get a buy from Heidi on that, too, we'll skip that step. We can decide that at the end. We also have a member from the American Academy of Neurology available to answer questions. So does that approach sound okay to the committee members?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Do we have a brief discussion, or do we need a vote?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, what I would like to do is have committee members express thoughts on reconsideration, yes, no, and why you feel that way before we spend time on a vote. Before we do that, does everybody have a copy of the letter from the Academy?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so we wouldn't. Does anybody feel a need to review that, or can you just read the material in front of you? Okay, so hearing no request for a reading into the minutes, we'll just use the written letter that we've received from the Academy. Likewise, on the minutes from our November 19 meeting where this measure was considered, does anybody need a reminder about that? Okay, then let's hear from the committee members on thoughts about reconsideration or not.
This is Alan Levine. I was very interested in the letter, and as I was thinking about this before the call, it occurred to me that, again, maybe this is an issue involving the failure of oversight in the context of, I don't know, if many of you may be aware of the risk evaluation mitigation strategy requirement that Congress imposed on the drug industry several years ago, when for high-risk drugs that are approved by FDA, physicians have to do more than their normal type of medical practice, if you will, in terms of explaining to patients the risks inherent in these drugs that are subject to REMS requirements. And I know at least one of the drugs, one of the epileptic drugs, particularly I think it's used in pediatrics, has a REMS associated with it. And I'm just wondering whether that's sort of another direction that one could go with this. If there is a problem in terms of side effects, maybe the associations, the industry should go to FDA and talk to them about imposing REMS on those drugs that have particular adverse reactions that physicians should go out of their way to make sure that patients are cognizant of and deal with appropriately.
Well, good point. Maybe we could include that in our report at some point. Thanks.
This is Iona. And actually, first of all, the response to the corrections I thought was appropriate that was made in terms of selecting it as a primary diagnosis, extending it beyond physicians, et cetera. So I felt that the proposer actually responded to our concerns. And then I had a second thought, which I don't like, but I'll put it out there anyway. The second thought was that we had the discussion we had earlier about primary versus secondary diagnosis and the burden placed on the system in terms of those with the secondary diagnosis and those who come in situations where it's secondary to some condition or it's it just isn't the primary diagnosis, and whether or not consultation, querying, investigation was appropriate to capture for that group. And what the second thought was that I had was, more often than not, I'm thinking those with a primary diagnosis of epilepsy are seeing specialists. Those with a secondary diagnosis may or may not be seeing specialists. And whether or not those with a secondary diagnosis that are being treated ought to be the ones we're more concerned about in terms of querying and investigating for side effects. So I put that out for more of a response and reaction because I don't know where I stand on that. It's just the second thought.
Okay, I think our first step would be whether we reconsider the measure or not, right? Other comments on that?
Do you think we should let the American Academy of Neurology make their case on the phone?
Okay, since we've got plenty of time, and that's fine. Can we open the line?
Good afternoon. This is Rebecca Swinning from the AAN. Can you all hear me?
Almost.
Could you talk up?
Sorry, I'm just going a little bit closer. Is that any better? Does that come out a little bit better?
Much better.
Yeah, it's much better.
Okay. I apologize. The two physicians that were working with us on this group were unable to attend this call because they had commitments in clinic this afternoon. So I am the AAN staff. I'm the senior manager for quality measurement and development at the American Academy of Neurology. And I'm here just to speak on behalf of the letter that they drafted along with our current president, who is Dr. Robert Griggs. Excuse me. I do also have a little bit of a cold. So one of the concerns, one of the major concerns that we had in this letter is that we felt that we had addressed the three primary concerns that the steering committee had regarding the specific measure. And it was unclear to us whereby we didn't meet those concerns. In one section of the letter, this is under, if you were to look in the letter underneath number one, the second bullet point, the concerns of the steering committee were not fully understood by the AAN, the measure developer. The draft report stated that the AAN made all the required changes to the measure and the committee appreciated the developer's efforts but did not believe these modifications sufficiently addressed their concerns and did not recommend this measure for endorsement. So we were asking that you please clearly restate the concerns and how the modifications were sufficiently not addressed.
Rebecca, do you need that? Unfortunately, the minutes from our meeting in November didn't get reflected in that write-up. If you'd like, I could read you the two key sentences.
Sure.
It's around the operational definition of query and counsel, and the committee's at that time first thought was the explanation of what constitutes querying and counseling was still too broad in its application to be used as this kind of a measure. The second consideration of the committee is that they believe that they did not have the evidence that demonstrates that failure to query and counsel would result in adverse consequences. So those two things I know didn't come through to you in the write-up, but they're in the minutes of our November meeting. And I think that was the crux of the issue, was the operational management of this measure. Does that help?
Yes, somewhat. excuse me, some numbers. Okay, I think I understand a little bit more about what the objection was at that time. I think one of the concerns was that that the steering committee had requested that we cite specific examples in the numerator of what would constitute querying and counseling about AED side effects. Is that where this objection is coming from for your first bullet point that you mentioned?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. And I know when we sent the reply back to the steering committee, we did cite specific examples in that we couldn't list absolutely everything that would possibly be included in the in the numerator statement simply because there are so many different side effects that would come. But we did say that we would list various examples that would be appropriate for this measure. I know the work group that developed these measures did feel that that was sufficient. I don't know if that helps with anything at all at this point.
Okay.
And to your second point, and I know in this letter we did include some additional information about the importance of counseling of patients about AED side effects. There was one study where 83% of patients sampled were concerned about new or worsening side effects from AED medications. 67% were concerned about drug interactions. And there were additional studies, multiple additional studies that have shown that AED side effects was the most important concern for patients with epilepsy between 5 to 35% of these patients.
Good. Okay. Anything else, Rebecca, or do the committee members have questions for Rebecca?
Sure.
Okay, any other evidence, Rebecca, that you'd like to share?
Just that there was one additional study that is, if you have the letter in front of you, which is reference number 9, counseling about AED side effects may lead to improvement in health-related quality of life for patients with epilepsy. And this was from a study by, I'm going to scroll down, by Sander, JW, Ultimate Success in Epilepsy, the Patient's Perspective in 2005. There is evidence to support that counseling a patient about AED side effects can actually lead to improved health-related quality of life and improved patient outcomes.
Okay. All right. Committee members, any other questions for Rebecca? Okay. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Do the committee members have any other comments on reconsideration, pro or con? Okay, would you like to move on to a straw vote?
Just ask a question.
Sure.
I mean, there's data here that suggests it's a potential concern to patients as they're on their anti-epileptic drug, but I guess the point that you had made earlier and was our concern during the committee meeting was the eventual outcome. Is that changed in any way related to the counseling? And I guess I don't know that we've seen any additional data to support that, have we?
All right, let's see. Rebecca, do you have any data related to that question?
Excuse me, if you could clarify as to what eventual outcome you are talking about. Do you have a specific outcome that you're looking at, like a specific measure that would be that you're looking to have qualified?
No, I would actually look to you to be able to make the argument that there are some outcomes of interest clinically, meaningful clinical outcomes that incorporating this level of questioning into the clinical arena supports.
Okay, I'm just looking at our data here. I apologize again since I am not the clinical expert on this. The one study, is, as I mentioned previously, is a study that looked at health-related quality of life for patients and saw increased improvements in that measure for patients with epilepsy. I don't have any additional information in front of me at this time.
Rebecca, this is Lisa. Just adding on, just further refining my my colleague's question concerning, are you aware of data that querying and counseling patients who are on AEDs that it demonstrates a reduction or an enhancement in patient safety? And I think where we're looking at is the patient safety outcome of it.
Sure. I believe there's.
Are you aware of any data there?
I'm just looking through. I think there was one bullet point in here about that. Just give me one moment.
Because what I'm reading about quality of life, which quality of life is different than patient safety, but I'm also reading the studies that you were citing concerning patients, you know, obviously the recognition that patients are concerned about side effects.
Correct. And
but
down
I'm
towards the end of the
patient safety.
So down towards the end of the letter, Dr. Nathan Fountain, who was unfortunately unable to attend this call, works, he's an epileptologist out on the East Coast and works hand-in-hand, and I'm not sure of the specific study that he's citing in this paragraph here, but it says that the AN contends that AED side effects include potentially fatal conditions such as falls, hepatitis, aplastic anemia, as well as less fatal but serious complications such as osteoporosis, peripheral neuropathy, and weight loss. Counseling about the potential side effects may prevent these safety complications or injuries. And I think that's getting at towards what you're talking about. I don't know the direct citation for this, but I could get that for you if you would be interested.
Well, I think that's the issue that says that counseling may prevent those. I think we're looking for evidence that there's been a study that counseling has helped decrease adverse events.
Precisely.
Okay, that was one question. Any other comments by committee members? Okay, once again, are we ready to look at a straw vote on this? Okay, anyone that would like to vote to reconsider this measure, please say yes. Okay, those that would like to not reconsider the measure, please say no.
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 No. Okay, thank you. I think that may conclude our meeting. Alisa, do you want to say something about next steps?
Sure. After this meeting, what staff would do, we'll redline the draft report with all of the suggested modifications that the steering committee agreed upon, and those include pooling measure number PSM-044-10. We will communicate all of the discussion and recommendations from the steering committee to the measure developer. And once we have incorporated those changes, we will forward the redline draft report to you for your review. And as Heidi mentioned, it's a very quick turnaround, so we hope to do that by the end of this week. And we will then post the report on the NQF website on March 4th for a 30-day public and member comment period. And we'll continue to keep you up to date on the SSI measures. As Andrew mentioned, the UTI measure, the UTI measures and the CLABSI measure are moving into this one report. And so we'll let you know the developments of the measure developers' discussions on the SSI measures.
So, Alisa, since we had a quorum on the phone, we had clear unanimous votes on both of these issues, we do not have to electronically vote?
This is Heidi. I would say that you don't. What we'll do is circulate this around and ask any committee members who were not on the call if they have issues to please raise them and reply to all. And then you, if we find that there are, then we can do an electronic vote. But
okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Yes, thank you. This has been a wonderful committee to work with.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Yes. Everyone.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.